Prayer by Tara Ağdaşlı.
Do you suppose that if I repeat the prose of this poem like beads of prayer or the prancing of a hungry feline around its prey, if I continue typing with my black nail polish on the silver keyboard, that my wishes will come true? Do I want to be under or overestimated? Maybe I take pride in being late every time we have to meet. Only because time has never been my friend, nor an enemy, just a person you always see at parties and never really find the interest to greet. Do you think if we were lovers and you saw me now, in love with the man of my dreams, vows exchanged, a life of two, forever in his arms, ugly or hot, only for him, would you be jealous? Do you find it annoying when I laugh? As much as I hate anyone chewing gum nearby. Do you find it thrilling when I dance? Are you charmed or irate by the number of times I've said I? How obnoxiously self-aware. Do you think friends are ever family, or that your family can ever be a friend? Is it childish not to want to be alone, the delusion of solidarity, the delight of community? Do you think art is ever more important than life? And is my life a waste chasing art? And what of politics? What of it? How do we permeate the impenetrable constellation of fate and the drama of power? Home is the only policy I have left. Human is the only power worth fighting for. Do you suppose that if I repeat the prose of this poem like beads of prayer, or the prancing of a hungry feline around its prey, if I continue typing with my black nail polish on the silver keyboard, that my wishes will come true? Do you suppose that if I repeat the prose of this poem like beads of prayer, like beads of prayer, like beads of prayer?
Hey, this is Ali Ruskash, and welcome to the AR Podcast.
This is the AR Podcast.
AR Podcast.
In the eyes of a young teenager, moving into a new house could mean loss of friends you've spent a long time getting to know. It could also mean exploring a new world, taking in all the information possible to finally get to know your surroundings. Now, what goes through the mind of a 14-year-old when the entire scenery changes right before their eyes, when the family decides to immigrate to another country? Tara Ağdaşlı took on this very demanding challenge in the year 2002. She embraced the new world she had stepped in, fully understood the magnitude of the change, and in the process, became who we now know of.
You left Iran when you were 14 years old, and for a 14-year-old girl or a boy, it doesn't really matter, it's a very, I'd say, difficult experience even to change schools. And the fact that you have to adapt with a new situation and you have to find new friends, that's a huge deal for a teenager. So how did you adapt with the fact that you left Iran and then the entire scenery in front of you changed, the fact that you basically have to change cultures kind of to adapt. So how did you do it? How did you accomplish that?
Oh God, how much time do you have? Yeah, it was honestly the most difficult experience of my life. By virtue of the age, obviously, I think at that age in Iran, I had just started to feel settled with my identity and my group of friends. And it was a huge shift to go from that to a country that obviously culturally is very different. But also Canada in particular, I think, is not like the States or like Europe. It is quite a, I don't know how to say this politely, but culture doesn't have a huge part in Canada, and it was a huge part of my identity. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really feel like there was anything or anyone that I could latch on to there. There was a huge sports culture, for example, in my high school, and I liked to play basketball, but that wasn't really my entire thing. So I really struggled with finding people to talk to. Even Iranians who I knew there were either older than me or, you know, kind of a little bit different to me. So I have to say, like, the 4 years of high school there was a lot of, like, full of confusion and isolation and very emotional. I was a very emotional teenager, but then the move just heightened that. And I guess how I dealt with it was I tried to kind of get into, but especially towards the end of it, I started sort of signing up for the basketball team. And, I tried to kind of integrate a little bit more into that culture, whatever it was. Because I think a lot of times with Iranian immigrants or any immigrants, the most comfortable scene is obviously your own community. And Canada is great in the sense that it does invite you to take part in its broader sort of society and culture. So I started really pushing myself to get into it. And I started, you know, I really worked on my language skills. Especially from high school to university, once I entered university, I felt a bit more confident with my communication. And so I started just hanging out with more local Canadian people and people who liked or shared my interests. It came together a bit more in university, and I felt very different. Within 4 or 5 years, I really felt more confident and settled into my new environment. But I tell everyone, like, you can't really escape the misery of the first few years. Even if you speak English, even if you have loads of money, like, no matter what assets or privileges you have, it's going to be a very difficult transition. And, you know, I wasn't very different to everyone else in that sense.
You said that you were going to go to a trip, and all I could think of was, how safe is it for anybody to go to a trip right now? Like, you know, with the COVID-19 and everything, did you follow any, like, you know, protocols, or, like, you know, were you aware of the craziness?
When I went to Canada?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm one of the many Iranians for who the family has been, you know, completely spread around the world. Yeah. And our base has been in Toronto for a long time. So I had, you know, planned to go back there in March. But then obviously with the COVID situation, we waited and waited and waited. And then it got to a point that I was like, I have to see my family, because both my father and my brother were there at the time. Thankfully, because I'm a Canadian citizen, I was allowed back in. And it was, we waited for some regulations and things to kind of loosen up a bit. Yeah. And then we just basically went there. We had to be isolating, which wasn't a problem. And that was it. And, you know, comparing to the UK, where I'm based now in London, Canada is actually a lot more safe, let's say, or at least it feels safer. It's dealt with the pandemic much more effectively. So it was actually nice to be in quarantine there with the family as opposed to in London, which can get a bit, you know, confusing and hectic with all the changing policies every day and all of that. So
okay, and the fact that you're here with me, you know, and I'm talking to you, just safe and sound, it makes me very happy.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's definitely a lot of distance between us.
Yeah. So, Tara, nobody really, I don't know if anybody has asked you this question before. Every time you go to an interview, like, you know, because everybody knows you as who you are right now, and nobody really talks to you about the fact that, like, you know, you obviously have had a journey before you became, you know, this, the figure that we know of today. So can you tell me, how did you become the Tara that we know of today?
Ooh, well, I don't know what Tara you know, because it's all very subjective. But in terms of who I feel like I am today, I can tell you that it definitely has been a journey that started back in Iran, obviously. And as you might know, I grew up within a very sort of cultural, artistic family. So I always felt very attracted to possibilities of both the creative world, but also just, I think my family was very encouraging of me to kind of follow my dreams and be who I want to be, which especially for Iranian families, I know that can be very novel, because a lot of times you have to be a doctor or a lawyer. So since an early age, I feel like I had a bit of an ADD. I loved art. I loved to write. I also really liked astronomy, and I liked social justice issues. I was always very attracted to, that sort of realm of things with human rights and philosophy and history. So when I was really young, you know, as a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old, it felt like there was too much to do. And I'm not looking back, I'm not surprised that it took such a long time and doing many different things, a lot of them at the same time, to get to a point where I'm really settled into writing and working on films.
And the fact that you're talking about the fact that, like, you know, you had a lot of dreams when you were a kid, you have basically accomplished most of them. So congratulations.
Thank you. Except for astronomy.
Yeah. Maybe in the future.
Yeah. For a long time, you know, especially when I got into journalism, a lot of people kept telling me that, you know, if you are to be a serious journalist, you can't really be an artist or do other things. And whether it was some professors or colleagues, a lot of people kept telling me that, you know, journalists have to be very objective and their voice has to be sort of hiding behind the story and the news and the facts. And I mean, the world has also changed in the past 10 years. I think journalism has changed. But that was really the expectation. And that was one of the things I really struggled with, because I did feel like I wanted to do more than, you know, the 500 word count limit that they had given me, or the 15 minute slot on whatever TV program I was making stuff for. So it did feel a bit constricting. And I felt like any day now I'm going to sort of break out of this shell.
Yeah.
But in many ways, the work I did and what I learned in journalism school and all the side sort of interests that I studied in university, so philosophy, history, art, they did kind of really complement each other in the long term. So I don't regret doing anything that I've done until now, but and a lot of people, when they ask me if, you know, they should go to journalism school, and I never know why anyone would ask me for advice. I do think a lot of it is what you make out of it. And There isn't a blueprint, especially with these things, with medicine, with law, it's a lot more. The path is quite clearly set out for you. Yeah. But in these types of fields, you just have to be very hungry and very, and be okay with taking rejection, because rule number one in journalism and in film, I think, is how to deal with hearing no, because you're going to hear a lot of no's before you ever hear a yes. So
you are a kind of person that I know, I know your kind. You always I'm pretty sure you are multitasking all the time. And the fact that you've gone from I'd say different categories of works and jobs, basically going to curation and then to filmmaking. And you right now you've settled as a filmmaker, I believe. But I'm pretty sure that that's not going to be the last that we're going to see from you. I'm pretty sure you're going to go into something else, maybe astronomy in the future. So, yeah. So what is how do you get the energy? Where is this driving force coming from?
I'm tempted to throw in an astrophysics formula for you. But when you have a lot of energy, you have to transform it into another thing. And I do have a lot of energy. I don't know where it comes from. I'm just curious. I'm a curious person. And I think you see that in everything that I do, whether it's, journalism comes from a curiosity to learn about other people and their stories and their plights or successes. Same thing with curation. Curation was me seeking out other artists and connecting with their work and wanting to give them a voice. Same thing with filmmaking and writing, which is a nice mixture of expressing yourself, your emotional status, your point of view, whilst as well as seeking out other stories that you encounter every day. So I think I've always been my antennas have been very high up, and I've just since I was a kid been picking up a lot of what happens around me. And what I realized was that if I don't channel it out in whatever way form, then I just start to crash. So a lot of it is also just selfishly keeping me going. When I decided to stay in London and I got married, I was really freaking out about, because at that time I had also started to change my career a little bit more towards films and personal independent work. And I was freaking out because I wasn't used to not going into the office or going to university 5, 6, 7 days a week. And I started working from home more. And I was I felt very anxious that, oh my God, why am I at home? Like, am I just going to be a housewife now? This is messing up with my head. But very soon things started to happen because, I was able to now focus on my own work and find a new rhythm. In many ways, I don't feel like things have changed so much. But when I look back, you're right. It's been curating and writing and poetry. And I'm sure it's going to go through more transitions. So,
yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen next. So, you said basically you were curious, and that's why you went to journalism. And then you were you wanted to connect with artists, and that's why you went to curation. Then you became a writer, and how did you even think of poetry at some point? When did you know that you had the ability to start poetry?
So it's funny because in many ways, writing poetry is the baseline for all of these. It started before any type of professional or vocational opportunity came my way. I do credit also the fact that, my father's studio used to be in our house when I was little. So he had a room and it was filled with books. It was a library almost. And I was so enamored by these books, by these old books and their smell. And I loved reading. So I would even, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I would, without knowing how to read or write, I would take the books and just copy them without really knowing what I'm doing. I just liked books and I liked stories and I liked being able to, you know, write. So it really was very organic the way it started. And I was 8 or 9 when one of our best dearest family friends, Aylia Dashti, passed away. And that was my first encounter with death. He had a type of cancer and you know, he passed away. So I was very emotional when that happened. I really, really, he was like my uncle. And so I wrote a poem for him and I wrote the poem and I crumpled it and I buried it in my backyard. And it was so therapeutic for me, like having written how I felt in a poetic, you know, format. I use poetic loosely because I'm sure it wasn't a genius piece of prose, but that sort of started that habit. And it was really a habit. It wasn't necessarily to show anyone. I would just write a lot in my notebook and I read a lot. I was a bookworm. I was always reading, you know, in Iran or in Canada during recess or lunch break, I usually had a book and I was reading. So a lot of times I think that's how a lot of people start writing, because you're reading and you're thinking about stories and your imagination just takes over and you kind of put it down on paper. So I started writing actually a short story when I was 11 or 12. And again, I was in school and during class, I would write it underneath my desk. And I got caught by one of my teachers once and she confiscated the book.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. And then a few days later, no, but it has a good ending, because a few days later she came to me and she said, listen, I've read what you've written. I had written maybe 100 pages of it. And she said, you know what, in my class, you're allowed to sit here and finish writing this. So that's what I did. And I ended up writing this 300-page novel of some type. And, you know, my parents were encouraging it and, you know, and that teacher specifically. So I felt very excited by writing. And I honestly feel like if I never left Iran, I would just be writing, because what threw me off was going to Canada and now dealing with an entire new language. And all of a sudden, what was my strength, which was writing, was a weakness.
Yeah.
It took a few years to master the English language and then sort of meet literature and writing again and make friends with it and say, you know what, maybe I may not even have a perfect English, but this is what I like to do and I want to write. So I started writing poetry in English and I started publishing poetry in English. And I realized that, you know what, this is still possible for me to continue. And that culminated in 2011, publishing my poetry collection in Farsi with Shahram Publication. And yeah, and for me, poetry has never been work. You know, it's never been a job. It's been a first language almost. You know, so I don't think it's ever going to go away. And I don't really care if I publish or not. It's its own thing. So,
okay. Then you went to filmmaking, which for me is, it's practically, I'd say, poetry in motion. You have some sort of an idea in your head and you make it a possibility for everybody else to see what, you know, your imagination was. So I'd say, again, how did you know that the filmmaking was going to, like, you know, become something that you have a passion for?
I was always a movie buff. I always enjoyed cinema and studied it. I think one of the reasons in that critical age of choosing my university degree, one of the reasons I didn't do cinema, because I had done some theater workshops at that time, and I was always thinking about different script ideas. And even my mom had, you know, would tell me, like, why won't you go and study cinema? You love cinema so much. I think a part of me wanted to do something, quote unquote, more serious, because I felt like, A, because of my dad being in the art world, if I enter the art world professionally, everyone's going to say, oh, it's because of her dad. And At that time, I wasn't equipped to think about dealing with that all the time, because it still follows me. I just don't care. And so that was one thing. And another thing was, I really did think that maybe I can be more helpful to society if I am a journalist. And that also turned out not to be true. So it got to a point where I was like, this has been with me, and I've kind of been not listening to this voice, either because I'm too shy or maybe I'm too scared. Like, let's be honest, maybe it's easier to do something, for me, journalism and television work, without really thinking that you belong there, because you're always removed from it. And you can always say, well, I don't love it. So in a way, even if you, you know, do something that you're not super proud of, it doesn't matter. It's not your thing, the capital thing, you know?
Yeah.
But if you enter something and you say, no, this is what I love to do, and I think I might be good at it, then the failures are magnified, and, you know, everything is just that. The stakes are higher for everything you do. Yeah. So I think maybe it was a fear factor too, but either way, when I started doing this documentary that I worked on about my father, which was a nice culmination of this history of a lot of Iranians always sort of looking at me differently because of who my dad is. And my documentary work and work with sort of facts and real stories, this documentary seemed to bring these worlds together and tie it in a nice bow and almost close that chapter for me. So it was an incredible project to do. And once I started doing that, because I already knew that I love working with images, and as you said, it is really poetry of motion. I really saw a lot of possibilities with working not just on paper, but with a visual medium. And I always have been a very visual person. So going into documentaries just gave me the skills and opened this, you know, universe of film. And it was just too tantalizing not to jump into. So at this point, I'm in it. So I'll tell you how it goes in a few years, but I am really enjoying it. Yeah,
and I'm really looking forward to see what's going to happen next. I saw this music video that you had basically directed, and it was pretty interesting for me because it had some sort of the French sort of a noir sort of a feeling to it, and I really really did like it. And and I saw an ad. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, was for a certain type of a perfume, if I'm not mistaken. And then now, like, you know, I'm really, really, I am waiting for the documentary to come out, because I've been going through the website to see if like, you know, we're getting closer for it to get released. And I really want to watch it, not only because it's got, you know, it's got basically talking, like, you know, about somebody who I really adore, and, well, you know, who's your dad. And, like, you know, it's got you as well. I really want to see, like, you know, what you have brought into this documentary. So I can't wait to see that. But talking about your work, what has been your favorite project till date?
I mean, obviously, I have to say recently, just the documentary I did with my dad tops everything, you know. I mean, it was the most intensely emotional experience. And it just kept me up so many nights, so many times I thought, what the hell am I doing? Can I just disappear and run away and not finish this? Because it's intense to look so closely at someone so important to you. So that was definitely not only a great experience as a storyteller, but also it just brought me so much closer to my father, and it made me really understand him on a new level. which, you know, hopefully when the film comes out, you'll know what I mean and why I say that. Yeah, sure. But I also have had a lot of, I've learned a lot doing every single project has been such a learning experience for me. And that's what I love about what I do, is because I'm constantly, you know, I can pick a subject, I can throw myself at it and feel like I'm reinventing the wheel for myself, you know. Sure. And that's the curiosity aspect that comes into play. I never get bored, and I even have projects that I've done. One of the first ever articles I did in Canada for Ottawa Citizen, which never got published because there were some issues with not being able to publish it anonymously. But it was a woman who was a Haitian refugee, and I basically found her, and I got very close to her and met her children and basically did this entire feature story on her. And I remember how it was a very sort of, you know, it touched me a lot to meet someone so vulnerable at the time in Canada. And again, it was one of those things where I felt how I felt like these stories are important to be heard, and we need to come, you know, they bring us closer to each other, whether it's in a format of a news or a short film or a feature film or a documentary. I do want to be able to shed light on human experiences. And yes, music videos are fun. I don't think they are life-changing. Some of them are, but a lot of them are just, you know, great fun. And I'm glad that commercials are becoming a little bit more conscious of their impact too. So for example, it wasn't a poetry, a perfume commercial. It was actually for a clothing brand, and it's a sustainable brand that's made by this young woman in London. So for me, it's also, I like to be involved with projects that I kind of believe in and still, you know, continue to grow as an artist.
Okay, fine. And I was a little bit distracted by, is that a cat or a dog? It just went on the chair. say hi to it later.
I will. Yeah. I'm obsessed with animals, and then my cat is just, yeah.
Yeah.
So fine. So can you tell me what's next for Tara? What are we going to see from you next?
So, I mean, as you know, with the COVID situation, like everybody else, a lot of my projects and plans shifted. So a lot of things were postponed that I was supposed to be working on this summer. Yeah. But right now I've developed, what was great about COVID, I mean, if I could use that sentence without being absolutely offensive to a human being, personally, it did force me to sit down and work on a few scripts that I was just, you know, as you said, I'm doing a million things at the same time. And script writing does need you to sit down and lock the world out and really concentrate. So I was able to really make way on some of these scripts that I had lying around. And at the moment, there is a short film that is in, I guess you could say it's in development. Mm-hmm. And there is a producer that I work with, and we're trying to finance that project. Although, again, with COVID, things are a little bit tricky. With my documentary that we talked about, we were planning to release it this summer. We had some festival plans, screening plans. All of that has also been a little bit upside down, yeah. So I'm still excited because we do have some plans, hopefully, if things go well, for fall and spring for the documentary, which I will definitely announce as soon as it's concrete. And then I have some, you know, commercials that I'm working on and little projects here and there to keep working, essentially, as always, you know, keep learning.
Okay. So every time I think about the fact that I'm living in a, I'd say in the most chaotic time with the COVID-19 and everything else, every time I remind myself of the fact that I still have the access to technology, and I'm blessed with the fact that, like, you know, we're living in 2020, and it's pretty easy to, like, you know, talk to, like, you know, very interesting people like yourself. And, like, you know, just imagine if we were living, like, maybe 100 years ago on this, like, you know, the like COVID-19, something like that would have happened. I'm pretty sure, like, you know, I would have died inside my house, like, you know, just isolating. Yeah. So thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to sit down and talk to you. I, like, you know, it was maybe 3 weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, that I first contacted you, and you were, you know, generous enough to like, you know, grant me like, you know, the time. So thank you so much. At the time, maybe I didn't think it was going to be possible, but thank you again for making it possible for me.
Thank you so much for thinking of me. And like you, I think it has, you know, having the technology to connect with people everywhere in the world, it's been a real silver lining. And you know, as always, I think there's ways out of the chaos. And I mean, I don't know how, I think in Iran, it's a different situation. And so kudos to you for coming up with a project that hopefully is interesting, at least to you, if not to anyone else. No, and I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure it's going to be great. And hopefully I'll speak to you again anyway.
If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you so very much. Now, none of this would have been a possibility without your support, and without the support of Odibesh Pastry. They have a variety of amazing cookies and cakes. And not only they look amazing, but they also taste wonderful. You can find them on Instagram at Odibesh Pastry. This has been Ali Ruskash, the creator of the AR Podcast.
This was the AR Podcast.
AR Podcast.